Hello, Professor Henry Chapman, and welcome to Time Team. Congratulations from all the Time Team on your professorship at Birmingham, which you've had for 2 years, which is fantastic. I've got fond memories of Birmingham. I did my first degree there. But back in the day, I did English and sociology, and I can't tell you what a hippie subject that was in the day. So, what was your role on Time Team?
I was the surveyor on Time Team for almost 10 years, I think. But I also did sort of introduced really digital mapping and known as GIS. So actually looking at sort of landscapes on a computer rather than just what Stuart was doing in the field.
And do you know how many episodes you did, Henry?
I did over 100 episodes because I remember receiving a trophy when I got to the 100, which I have on my shelf. But it was probably about 120. And I've tried to count the number of episodes a few times. And because there's a combination of normal episodes and then there are the extra specials, and it actually becomes quite difficult to define what do we mean by an episode almost.
Well, 100 is definitely a long service medal. So can you reach the thing that you got?
There it is.
Stunning. I don't know how many of those were handed out. I think that was quite a rarity.
Yeah, I have no idea. I remember Kerry getting his probably more than 100.
Yes, Kerry, it would have definitely been a recipient to one of those, I would have think. Your role, you've talked about GIS mapping on a specific Time Team. We're there, we've done the geophysics, we've started the excavation. When were we shouting for you, and at what point did you come in?
So I sort of had two roles. The primary role was doing the surveying, so making sure that was quite often right at the very start to set out grids for geophysics, that kind of thing, or to establish where a trench should go. And then throughout the process, it was continually recording trenches. So it was making sure that information was available so we could always have some way to go back to see where we were effectively, because things could become very, very busy. But amongst all of that, depending on the site, sometimes it became important to think about it, sort of step back from the trenches a little bit, or to try and understand what was in the trenches by taking a bigger perspective. One of the sites I remember like that was Green Island in Poole. I don't remember which series it was, but one of the things about that site was that it was so difficult to understand on the ground, partly because it's very heavily wooded, but also because sea level had changed so dramatically since the Iron Age, when the site we're looking at. So to actually understand the bits of archaeology which were under the sea, so divers had found this stuff. To try and make sense of all these things, you had to kind of put it into a map, but then that map had to be in three dimensions, and it had to have a level of reconstruction of lowering that sea level to try and understand it. It's things like that which it's not always the first thing to do on any site, all sites, but for some sites it becomes really helpful because it's the only way really you can get a proper context.
And I particularly remember it was always very comforting for me was the business that if we were working on a piece of archaeology, we found some structural remains or even some finds, you very quickly were able to locate, if you like, those finds. In the past, we were taking coordinates from various things on the site, but when you were there, we could very quickly say, right, Henry's done these. And that seems to be a critical thing of what you did as well.
Yeah, I think one of the many questions often get asked professionally is you didn't really do it in 3 days. Yeah, it was that, and yeah, we did. And and part of the reason is because we were able to do things like that. It was the team, but being able to immediately record something so it didn't hold you up. It didn't hold up the excavation. You could move. You could lift that object because it had been recorded. And what was great was working with Wessex Archaeology at the on programs, because it was, that's the other bit I'd forgotten actually. But at the end of the site, well, throughout and at the end, it was making sure all the archive all of that was recorded properly. And that just became a very fast process, as well as the stuff people saw on screen. It was that ability to actually finish the site and do that responsibly for the archive for future people.
And I think I particularly remember you liaising with Steve Thompson, for instance.
Yeah.
Which was a great combination, because it gave all us the security that whatever we'd done, you knew where it was, whatever we found, it had been located, and all that information transferred over to Steve so Wessex could do the reports.
Yeah, it was great fun working with Steve, and I've seen him a few times since. And one of the great things with Time Team, we worked processes, and we sort of created new processes. And yeah, I use those now. The stuff which we developed during Time Team, it's invaluable. And I suspect Steve's the same. But that working together, so we could be very, very efficient. And when you're working on a 3-day program or 3-day timescale, that's really important. And it's the same as having the other specialists on site. You could get answers to questions immediately.
You've sort of answered this question, but what do you think made Time Team work so well over sort of 250 programs? What made it work?
It was a team. I think the thing which worked really well, we're a great team. Everybody knew what they were doing. Everybody respected what each other were doing, despite all the banter and everything else. But it was that ability to work and to almost implicitly make changes to how we did things, to always keep on pushing the efficiency, always, it could be very, very highly, it could be very intense at times, and actually having a good team which you could always rely on, and people sort of, other people having your back almost, second guessing what was about to happen. I think that's what made it work so well. I think the range of personalities, I think Mick was just incredible. As well as sort of keep holding everything together. It is an incredible loss, but it was the team. It was the shared interest. Yeah.
Did you ever get a sense of? Well, I'm sure you did. A sense of satisfaction when you looked at a Time Team report. I never know how many people actually look at these things. We have to do them. I've got shelves of them, but did you ever sort of glance through them and see the detail that you delivered in those reports where Steve had sort of worked it up into the content?
Yeah, no, I'm really proud of the reports. I mean, the archaeology we were doing, I think, was very, very good. And I think the quality of what came out of it was exceptional. And yeah, when I look at those reports, when I work on them, they are really good. Yeah, I think we did a good service to that side of the archaeology as well.
Do you remember Greenwich?
Yes, I do. Yes, Tilt Yard. Yes,
I think that was the period when directors were keen on puns, so we ended up calling Joust Dig It, which I was never totally sure about. What do you remember about Greenwich?
Oh, Greenwich. The thing about Greenwich was it came just after. So in the order of filming, we'd just filmed Castle Howard before. And what I remember was when we were at Castle Howard, we came across the drawings. Was it Wren's drawings in Hawksmoor? The actual drawings of Greenwich. And in terms of the architectural plans before it was built. And so it was so incredible to then go to Greenwich, having just seen almost a blueprint. That was just, coincidence maybe. But that's quite stunning. Once we got there, there was it's just such an incredible site. I mean, you've got the Admiralty there, you've got, there's so much at Greenwich anyway. I hadn't worked in London many times. We've done Vauxhall and other sites. So working in London, that was quite an experience. But the actual site itself, it was a really interesting one because it's a very high profile story. But at the same time, the archaeology was, some of it was very ephemeral. If you start talking about finding a tilt yard, that's quite ephemeral archaeology potentially.
My memory of it was a bit thin on the ground.
I suppose it was a shoot of contrast, wasn't it, in that sort of respect. But I also remember doing the measurements to try and work out which building is it. I mean, it's always the thing, if you've got lots of relatively small trenches with bits of masonry. So how do they all link together? Right, and you have to sort of stand back and try and sort of join the dots. But yeah, I've really enjoyed that series. 10 was great fun. That was a really good series.
And did that, when we found that the joust site, that's the area where the knights with, because it was always that incredible contrast, as you say, between the visual images. I think we got a Victor drawing to give us an idea of the two knights sort of coming together and all this wonderful happening. But we on the ground were looking for slightly hardened hoof print. And I was never quite sure whether I was totally convinced by the end. But I think Stuart and you were that, you know, we had actually found something because of its dimensions, I think.
Yeah. No, the dimension, I mean, this is great working with with architectural historians, you know, like getting again, it's one of those great beauties of time. If I'd been working on that as a site, I would never have known that was a question I could have asked. Yeah, it's this range of expertise. So when you have somebody saying, oh, okay, they've got to be, I don't know how many meters it was, you know, the dimensions are standard or well recorded, then suddenly that gives you a whole new way of actually looking at the evidence. So assume that's correct, then therefore, actually, if the measurements all stack up, and if I remember rightly, they're like to the centimeter or something ridiculously spot on, you know, in a way which is like, I can't be right. But yeah, so it's that combination of skills. I mean, I always get shocked by expertise. People are really good at what they do, and they understand enough about what you do or what I do, and then they can sort of, yeah, and they can make the link. Yeah, it's like magic, isn't it? It's like sort of alchemy. I don't know.
Always thought that Time Team had a certain sort of après-ski element to it, where having we'd finished the dig and everything, we would then go back to the hotel, and various characters would, I'd usually try and go to bed early, but inevitably these things could go until, I remember there seemed to be some event around changing beds, which you were the subject of at one point.
Yeah, so I remember this one, yeah, alarmingly. So this was in, that might have been the Fetler shoot. It was up, it was Scotland. And it was, oh God, that was, a variety of things. It was one of those places, absolutely beautiful, yeah, stunning scenery. And the hotel was made of a number of lodges, which were all facing inwards at each other, which always seemed a bit bizarre. But there was all sorts of things, climbing through windows and rearranging people. I mean, it's completely childish. It's brilliant. And I think my favourite one was naming no names with Kerry, which was we had the radios from site, and because he had the different channels, and one of them was just radio to radio, line of sight. And Kerry had managed to get in through the window of somebody, I think it's Kerry, somebody's room. They basically put a radio under the bed. So he waited until quite late and then pretended to be a ghost. And because everybody had been drinking, they had the desired effect. So having the voice coming from under the bed as he was talking to them. Yeah, very, very silly. It all made sense after a drink.
Oh, it did. So you're at Birmingham now. You've been there for a while. What's the next stage for you and the projects that are really making you excited about? If we were making a film of something, where would you like to take us, and which project would you like us to follow?
Well, I'm working on a range of projects. I mean, I think top of the list for me, yeah, if I'm really selfish with it, I'd probably be looking at the Bog Bodies work I've been doing in Denmark. Primarily in Denmark and elsewhere, but
and what is that in detail? What do you mean the bog bodies work?
So bog bodies being sort of preserved remains of humans in peat bogs, and one of the big debates is
dates. Henry, from where?
The earliest ones Mesolithic. So, but they're always considered to be a sort of Iron Age, later prehistoric kind of phenomenon. They're later ones as well. But one of the big debates, particularly for the Iron Age ones, is are they victims of human sacrifice? because for a number of reasons, sometimes they're naked, they're brutally killed and all the rest of it. But one of the things which hasn't been looked at until we started has been whereabouts in the bog. What's the bog like? There's sort of landscape context. If you imagine sort of Stuart coming to the role with an environmental archaeologist, it's that. And the reason why it's really important is that obviously if it's a very wet and treacherous landscape, if you're going to murder somebody, which is one of the possible interpretations, you're probably not going to walk right into the middle of a dangerous bog. So you know, where the individual is on the middle or edge. If it's a normal grave, it's probably more likely to be on the edge. You know, there's, you know, we can start thinking about that context. So trying to understand, you know, the work I've been doing has been trying to understand, well, what is the context of that body find? And because environments change through time, you know, the bogs grow and then they're cut back. Where was the actual edge of the bog in the Iron Age? Nobody ever asked these questions. You know, was it on the edge or was it in the middle? And this really helps in terms of interpretation. But what I'd like to do is I'd like to expand that to the landscape around it and to broaden that. So I mean that's selfishly, I mean that's an area which I'd love to throw time team apps. But equally, I mean working there's so many other questions. I mean I have projects working in basically hill forts in bogs. To Iron Age again, which again, it's a big landscape. It goes, the great thing with time team, it went from the very, very sort of minute, you know, the object, all the way through to the landscape. And I think, and it's seamless, really. And I think that approach to either of those two topics is really valuable. But even, you know, the work I've been doing at Stonehenge, you know, actually the idea of, you know, most of the work we've been doing has been very heavily geophysical. It's been very much on that end of things. And I think, well, if you broaden the team in the way which any time team can do, suddenly you have all those inputs all at once, and then it makes it more alive. Rather than sort of you do this, you interpret it, then you talk to people. What happens is you do it, talk to people, continue doing it, change what you're doing. It's that which I think, yeah, you know, that's the disruptive kind of exciting thing about working like time team.
And I think somebody, I think the New Scientist or something referred to it being a sort of testing of numerous hypotheses that, you know, while we're there, we'd start with an idea that would be hypothesis A, and we'd get to F and G, testing each one on the ground at the time. They also described it as a good illustration of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Not quite sure what they were getting at, but we never quite knew, did we, whether or not we find it. So how are you coping at the moment, Henry? You've got students out there and you're doing lectures on Zoom or something. What's your daily routine?
Yeah, daily routine is it's a lot of Zoom, a lot of lectures like that. There's a lot of recording lectures. What we're doing, like many universities, is trying to be a few weeks ahead, just, you know, to cover all certainties. There's still face-to-face bits, but it's the face-to-face teaching is quite bizarre because, you know, in Birmingham we do quite a lot of small group teaching, you know, 10 students, 12 students. But you imagine, because of social distancing, we now have that in a huge lecture theatre. So you've still got your small class, but there's like distributed right across. So
there's six of you in a space that would have taken 200.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. So yeah, that's a bit odd. We don't get the students sitting on the back row, thankfully. but yeah, it's working, I think. It's very odd. Yeah.
And how many students going through your courses at the moment at Birmingham?
So in terms of our archaeology, sort of directly related, probably about 25 a year. In groups in terms of undergraduate, but of course we're teaching archaeology modules to a vast, you know, much bigger range of topics, you know, a lot of other degree programs. Then you've got the postgrads as well, the PhD. And one of the challenges at the moment is postgraduates getting out to do field work, you know, just those, you know, those other little elements. But you know, things are working, I think.
It's rather nice for me to think about my old stamping ground at Birmingham. I've talked to a lot of people about the archaeological science element of what's been done there. The unit, I think Vince Gaffney was there. He's gone somewhere else now. But there's always been an interest in, if you like, I suppose the tradition when I was there was that Birmingham had all these arts and things, but it always had its feet in the science of, if you like, the industrial base of Birmingham. Mm. And so they were always interested in the more sort of scientific applications going alongside the main subjects, because I think you're still in archaeology, classics, and something or other, aren't you?
Yeah.
So that's a big, you know, classical, typical degree. But it's very exciting to think of these new developments. And if you've got computer centres and scientists who are doing all sorts of things that you can call on.
Yeah. I mean, at one level, there's so much more you can do without having to have huge resource, which is one benefit. But yeah, through projects, we sort of built other sorts of computing resources and got equipment, got a good relationship with the geographers, yeah, because they're sort of their kindred spirits in many ways.
Often, I think, feel unloved sometimes, the geographers, don't they?
Yeah.
I mean, geography teaching at school, I think, but yes, I'm glad the geographers have been brought in.
No, it's always nice when the geographers. I mean, and sharing comments about whatever you're moaning about. But what often happens? You'll be talking about the thing which, you know, I'll be moaning about whatever restriction, like, you know, and they'll be moaning about something else. And then as soon as they hear my moan, they say, "Oh no, we solved that. This is what you do." So far, it's very handy.
I'm going to give you time, team, for a week. You can take the whole team with all the technology you like. Anywhere, any site in, say, let's say Europe for now, where would you want us to go? We call these sort of fantasy sites.
I've got various ones. I mean, just so this is slightly long-winded, but a colleague asked me recently and said, why do we keep on working at Stonehenge? Because it's had more people work at Stonehenge than anywhere else on the planet. Surely we should free up some of that funding and everything else and go somewhere else. What we found from all intense work at Stonehenge is actually, if you do throw resource at a single site, you get so much more. It's more than some of the parts. There's no diminishing returns. So Stonehenge, actually, I'll go for something like that, possibly. But
fantastic. Henry, thank you very much. Professor Henry Chapman from Birmingham University, I'm pleased to say. Delighted to talk. We could probably go on for a while discussing various memories of Time Team, but
no, it's really good to see you, Tim.
Thank you for your time. Lovely to hear from you. And I think it was great, that role that you and Steve and came into with the team and the way the team appreciated it. Because however testy we might get to get you in to get your points or the thing drawn, the thing located, we all knew that it was an essential part of what we did. And that was a great contribution. So
yeah,
I look forward to talking to you in the future.
Oh, yeah.
And perhaps seeing you out there in the field with as many technical machines as we can get in the truck as possible.
Brilliant. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Henry.